Hi, I'm Daniel Lenzian, host of Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios. Western New York Soundstage is a podcast that looks to explore Western New York's creative economy through a series of conversations with artists, musicians, producers, directors, and authors from Western New York and beyond. On today's episode, I speak with Keely Sheridan. Keely Sheridan is the artistic director of Irish Classical Theater Company and the director of Crocodile Fever, a play that's equal parts Thelma and Louise, Carrie, and Tarantino for Feminists, and is running through June 15th in Buffalo, New York. Tickets are available in the show notes and at irishclassical.com. In this interview, Keely and I talk about the process of directing, impossible stage directions, and the appeal of Crocodile Fever for theater enthusiasts and Buffalonians who are looking for an unforgettable night out. I hope you enjoy my interview with Keely. Keely Sheridan, thank you so much for chatting with me today. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. I'm so glad we got to jump on this call because this really is the end of the first season that you have planned as the artistic director of Irish Classical Theater Company. It's not your first season, but this is the first that you put together. I'm dying to know, what were the surprises now that everything is kind of all said and done?
I think the sort of overarching surprise, not surprise, I guess, pleasant surprise maybe, has been how open and welcoming our audiences have been to the new programming, and also how many new audience members we've been able to connect with through the shows this year. We've seen a lot of first-time patrons at Irish Classical, and we hope to keep welcoming them back. But yeah, it's always nice to hear, you know, my history with the company is not very old because I was brand new when I came here 2 years ago, and to hear patrons who've been with us for 35 years being supportive and enthusiastic about the programming has meant a lot.
That's incredible. Well, congratulations.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I'd love to now ask, we're here today to kind of talk about this sort of incredible wild ride that only has sort of one final weekend. So upcoming, mm-hmm. This is the final weekend of Crocodile Fever. For those who might just be listening, who haven't encountered anything of with the piece yet and might not be familiar with it, how would you describe it? What is it about?
So my tagline has been Dairy Girls meets Quentin Tarantino. I think it's this really beautiful piece of writing, and it's new. It was just written in 2019, I believe. And it's a sort of family dramedy set against the backdrop of a sort of national conflict, which was the Troubles. And so the play takes place in South Armagh, Northern Ireland in 1989. That'll be 6 years before the Good Friday Agreement, which was effectively sort of began the official talks of moving out of conflict. And so we're very much still in the height of the conflict. And there's this kind of undercurrent throughout the play of this bigger social conflict going on. But what we really see is a glimpse into this family's home and kind of how the sort of personal conflict plays out against that bigger backdrop. So it's the story of two sisters who, through some kind of extraordinary life circumstances, have found themselves apart and have the opportunity to come back together. And some of their obstacles are their differing memories of their childhood and trying to reconcile with each other events of the past, and realizing that as siblings, they kind of are built-in allies to each other and they have each other to rely on. But we see them throughout the play rebuilding a trust that was broken previously. And in the true sort of Irish dark comedic style, there is a lot of levity in the piece. There's a lot of humor as a coping mechanism for dealing with some really difficult themes. And I think the thing that excites me most about it is that it does take a sort of surreal turn kind of partway through the play until we begin thinking that we're in one play and we end up realizing we're in a very different play.
Absolutely. For our listeners, artistic directors and people who plan theatrical seasons have to read, I would imagine, hundreds of plays a year to really choose and create a season for its patrons. What was it about Crocodile Fever that when you picked it up and read it, you said, this is a play I have to direct?
I think the first thing for me was the humor, and seeing, becoming very early on aware in the text that the playwright was dealing with some really heavy themes, but I was laughing as I was reading it. And so I appreciated the humor. The voices are also very distinct of the two, of all the characters, but especially the two sisters who we follow, which was really appealing for me. You know, as an actor and a director, when I read text, I'm always, I sometimes can hear it in my head, how it'll sound. And so having that real distinct voice was exciting. I think too, it is an Irish play by a new Irish writer, and it's looking at a piece of the past, but it's from a writer who is living now, looking back. And that's something I'm really excited to explore with our programming, is how contemporary artists are engaging with either historic texts or themes or periods or people. And, you know, it has a lot of nods to kind of 80s horror, which is a genre that I am, you know, is sort of entrenched in my DNA as an 80s kid. And I found that very, very appealing and accessible to a modern audience who would have these kind of cultural touchstones, like the movie Carrie and some of the pop culture references that are made in the script, made it really appealing to me as well.
Yeah, I walked in. I mean, we'll talk about sort of the world of the play in a second. But when I walked in, mm-hmm. I was like, "That's Betty Buckley on the floor." From the movie Carrie. Yeah.
Yes.
It's just so fun. You know, you are also a teacher. You're an academic. You worked in the academy for a long time. And I'm just interested in engaging with this question, perhaps for just like selfish reasons. And there's no like heat behind it. But I think it's also would be interesting for our listeners. Like, how do you, because it's such a difficult job to describe, how do you describe the job of a director? Like, if a student was to sort of say, what is directing, or how do you teach directing, or what is it? How do you describe it?
I think for me, I describe it two ways. And the way I describe a director is also kind of the way I think about teaching acting, which is that I think I am a doula. I am sort of somebody helping shepherd the transition of a play from a piece of text on a piece of paper to a living, breathing experience. And so I also think of myself as an editor often, and not an editor of the text, because that's kind of in, if you're doing a text-driven process, that's the thing that's sort of set, but an editor of all of the other experiences, the visual and the sonic, and, you know, and that's with both designers and actors. I am a very collaborative director, and I love to see what other people bring in. And then I think my role is to make sure that all of the contributions from every creative involved in the process are either creating harmony or maybe dissonance, but intentionally, that we're always asking what the impact on the audience is going to be, and is that the one we want to have? So yeah, doula and editor combined, I think. But then in a practical term, right, there's a good deal of sort of project management that happens. You're managing the rehearsal room with the, you know, the assistance of the stage manager, but you're also managing all of the other aspects, kind of making sure that they dovetail together. Yeah, that's how I think answer.
That was fantastic. So for our listeners too, I think sometimes, like, in the process of theater making, and specifically plays, sometimes musicals, there's a lot more sort of information, or there's an expectation around what it should look like or what it should be, just because of sort of things that have kind of existed before, right? But with a play, I think a director gets this like little book, this little piece of paper that they have to kind of, as you said, bring to life. I'm fascinated to know, what are the stage directions like? Like, what I sometimes refer to a script with my own students as, like, it's like the blueprint for the play. What was this blueprint like for Crocodile Fever?
So like the first thing that comes to mind, and how much do I want to spoil? But I think it's such a perfect, the stage directions are bonkers. And there's a lot that we added to this process. We took a lot of liberty to always kind of, in good faith of the intention of the writer. So we added a lot of things on our own. But one of the stage directions that immediately, without the script in front of me, leaps into my head is the stage direction, Alana calmly stabs Da. And we were like, how do you calmly stab someone? Like, how does that manifest? And it was like a great source of joy to work with our incredible fight choreographer Audrey Avogadro to talk about like what is that. She doesn't just stab him, she calmly stabs him. And so I think this playwright, Megan Tyler, they're really good at leaving these kind of emotional cues and cues and clues, honestly, like little tracks along the way in those stage directions. They're not overly prescriptive, and yet, right, like what does it mean to calmly stab someone? What we took from that is that there's a real kind of moment of clarity for this character, and she is making a decision instead of reacting. And so there's a lot of fun in there. I mean, there's a crocodile in the play too, so you know, it's very sort of Exit Pursued by a Bear. Like you read it and you're like, how she looks at the ceiling, starts raining blood with the stage direction. And so it's been, there are a few that we didn't end up using, but truly just in a kind of like editorial process of trying to tighten the thing up and make it all feel very cohesive. But we honored a lot of the stage directions, and then we added a lot of business ourselves too. A lot of the kind of, there's a real motif of Catholic rites and rituals in this play. And so we were able to weave a little bit more of that into the stage business as well, which I think kind of underpins one of the characters' emotional journeys. But the stage directions are nuts.
Yeah. That's, I mean, crazy. It's an incredible thing about contemporary writing now too, where I feel like, you know, there's sometimes what's referred to, or what I've all referred to as like the impossible stage direction.
Yeah.
Something so fun about like, it's raining blood or something like that, that you have to sort of work through. But I think that it's thrilling for audiences to step in because it is so different than a film. It's not a passive experience.
No, for sure. And I also just need to shout out to our whole design team, Primo and Diane and Mark and EL and Matt DeVita, because they really did help me decode some of those more impossible feeling stage directions, not only to what they could be sort of gesturally, but also how they would work in our space, because the piece is, we have a few seats off limits, but really in the round. And so an impossible stage direction becomes even more impossible feeling when you need to do it in 360.
Let's talk about kind of walking into the world of this play, because it is so specific. And the theater, one of the amazing things about this season, and I think this is true in the past, but certainly like I've definitely noticed such a huge shift in the Andrews Theater, is it? Forgive me. The Andrews Theater.
The Andrews,
every time you've walked in this season, in terms of kind of the world of the play, right? And this one, can you give listeners just like a tidbit of how we're sort of like, when they walk into the theater, what they sort of see and experience? We mentioned Carrie already. If that hasn't sold them, I don't know.
What,
please tell us more.
I think there's this great Anne Bogart quote that I always sort of like paraphrase, that she talks about in, I forget which book it is, that directing is, you can think of directing as like planning a surprise party for someone you love. And you imagine all of the steps of like, how they'll walk into the space and what's the first thing they'll see and what'll they smell and what'll they hear. And what I just said about the designers, I completely neglected to mention our amazing sound designer, Mason Beggs, who has been a really incredible thought partner in sort of exploring sonically how we can invite an audience into the world, especially because we do have this really cool opportunity of being a 360 theater and really, sort of enveloping people in our space. That is a conversation that is very, I have very early in the process, because that dipping into the world with the audience is kind of like where I start from. Like, what do I want them? Do I want them to feel sort of like they're creeping into a place, or they're sucked into a space, or, you know, like what is their journey? So I think that there are both opportunities and challenges to doing that in our physical space, but it's something that's really important to me, that you feel like you are somewhere else when you walk through the theater doors.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you mind if I sort of share a little bit of like what you can encounter, or like, it's like this incredible, wild, like pink, Pepto-Bismol pink kitchen in this like perfect sort of little house that is like incredibly manicured. And I remember thinking, and I'll just say this to listeners and seeing the show, oh my gosh, that set piece is so beautiful. How is that there? And then within minutes it's destroyed, which really kind of is a wonderful kind of surprise and shock about the rest of the play.
Yeah. I'm okay sharing what that is.
Sure.
It's the stained glass window. And so that's an example of, right, the stage direction is that Deanna breaks a window. And we were trying to figure out technically how to solve the issue of needing to replace a pane of glass every single show for all of the shows and all of the techs. And breakaway glass is very expensive, especially for the size of pane we would need, because later that character comes through that window. And so I think it might have been Adriano or Diane, somebody on the team whose department it wasn't even, had said, well, what if we explore the idea of a stained glass window, because there are natural sort of soldering lines that you could build some sort of breakaway ability. And then I was like, well, then it has to be the Virgin Mary's face, because this character punched through it in the beginning. And, you know, so yeah, I think that's exactly, and that initial dip into it, right, this is just the play. It's this perfectly preserved kind of hermetically sealed little biome that is not healthy, but is functioning. And when you introduce anything else into it, be it a family member who's been long gone, be it the sort of conflict that's coming in from the outside, everything is thrown out of balance very quickly. And so I wanted it to feel really pristine in the beginning, because the journey of the space from the top of the show to the end of the show is pretty transformative without actually moving any set pieces.
And that's amazing, because I thought that was part of the stage direction, that I was like, the stained glass window is broken. So it's thrilling to know that that's specific for ICTC and your production.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to sort of say to like our listeners who just to kind of take them a little bit behind the scenes, like about rehearsal processes, right? And like mm-hmm. how rehearsal processes in Buffalo are anywhere from like 3 to 5 weeks, usually sort of kind of concentrated in the evenings. This is a mammoth undertaking. Were you like, what was that? However long this was accomplished, because this feels like a play that you probably could rehearse for 2 years and still be continuing to discover things. How long was the rehearsal process?
So our rehearsal processes are always the same length. They're 4 weeks, and then we go into a week of tech previews, and we open at the end of that final week. And yes, this, you know, I think every rehearsal process is so different because of the needs of the text. And what this text needed was for us to be able to move around on our feet and figure out, there's so much movement of props and the, like the physicality of the piece is so important, and there's so much to keep track of, that for another play, I might've stayed at the table a little bit longer and done a little more sort of kind of text work and script analysis. We did a little bit of that, but I really wanted to get up on our feet quickly to empower the actors to find their path through this space and through this material, because it is so, so grounded in props and so prop heavy. And so we got up on our feet very quickly. We blocked it very quickly. And then we continued to tweak and come up with it, discover problems as we added more props, or as we, you know, figured out sort of the floor gets very slippery at one moment, and the, you know, like the spray radius of some liquid at some point, you know, we had to have a shell to start putting those, sort of special effects and kind of like more technical moments in. And so we did, I feel like we blocked this show faster than anything I've ever worked on before, but then we went back and reworked it kind of constantly. And yeah, like I always want more rehearsal. I don't think I'm ever done directing. We just get to the point where I have to shift my focus from the actors to the tech. And I'm so happy with it and so proud of it. But if you gave me another 2 weeks to rehearse it, I would take them.
Right. And but I think that also speaks to like a great process, right? Because it's very clear too that the actors are so grounded in reality, but there's a freedom inside of the performances. Can you maybe talk about that a little bit inside of the rehearsal mm-hmm. process of like how like the juxtaposition maybe between kind of like the setness of blocking, but then also the sort of freedom inside of that?
Yeah, I think part of it is casting is so important. Casting is crazy important. And you know, like I come from this background of teaching. And so there's a part of me that every time I interact with or, you know, audition a new actor, I'm like, oh, if we had this much time, we could get here, or that much time we could get here. But I got very lucky in casting this piece because I felt like everybody came in ready to find the show together. And there was nobody that needed to be really pulled along to have the tools to be able to find the show. And so as we were blocking, I was sort of a broken record in that, you know, we would try things on our feet, and I would always, until there was a point where we had to set things, encourage the actors to do what we did last time until you feel like doing something else. If something else comes up or something else comes along, give it a try and let's see, you know, because as they, and this is also maybe me speaking as an actor too, that as I become more familiar with the text, even if I come in totally memorized and off book, you still learn stuff when you're, you know, finally with your fellow cast members. And so as they're discovering things, they have the freedom to add them. We also do a lot of working really up until we're needing to run things in a sequence to kind of look at timing. They can stop at any point and say, hey, this worked last time, but now I have no idea why I'm coming over here to do this, or this doesn't feel right. And so my process is kind of, or my rehearsal room, I try to make it as informal as possible in that way, so that everybody feels like they're able to continue contributing to the conversation of what their impulses are telling them and where they need to be until we have to set it. And you know, these actors are really impulsive and they're really intuitive. And a lot of the best stuff that is in the show is stuff that they came up with on their own after we gave them a shape. So, yeah.
Well, we're heading to next. I have about two more questions, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So the process is kind of here, like I mentioned earlier in the interview, we're kind of at the last week of Crocodile Fever. What has surprised you from when you sort of first picked up the script, the hard copy, until sort of being in front of audiences or seeing in front of audiences? Like, what's been the biggest surprise or the biggest kind of, I don't know, aha or something?
So I've always known that the play is funny, and I was very nervous. There's this really delicate balance of, you know, especially the kind of dark comedy where the humor, you're constantly asking yourself, like, should I be laughing at this? Is it okay to laugh at this? Like, the stakes and the context are so extreme that you're put in this like kind of state of sort of nervous laughter or fear. And I was not worried, but I was really curious to see how people would react, because there's some pretty extreme things that happen in the play. And we go from thinking we're in realism to realizing we're very much not. And so I've been surprised at, you know, some of the things that the audience have really found funny that were kind of on the border of like, people might not laugh at this because it's so dark. And then I've also been so pleasantly surprised. I've only sat in now with an audience maybe like three times. But this piece is so beautiful in our space because there are a couple of surprises in the piece, and getting to watch other audience members who are seeing those surprises before you, or, you know, looking across the room at other people experiencing this thing, has been one of my favorite parts of this play, is seeing people look at each other to check in about like, what am I seeing and should I be laughing? And so it feels kind of extra communal that way, because we're all sort of taken off guard by this play.
That's great. For somebody who might be sort of sitting on the fence or thinking, I don't know if this play is for me, or I think I want to go, but maybe sometimes theater isn't necessarily my number one sort of choice of entertainment, what might you say to them?
I think this play in particular, it deals so heavily in kind of cinematic structure and cinematic motifs that I would encourage somebody, if they maybe weren't sure that they liked theater, but consider themselves someone who enjoys film, to give it a try. There is a lot of, I think, yeah, cinematic sort of storytelling. And I also think it is a play that will surprise you. And so maybe you're not sure that you like theater, but if you're open to being surprised, this play is probably not going to be what you expect it to be. And so I'd encourage someone who's got a mind open enough at least to try something new to try it on this play.
Would you also mind just sort of maybe briefly making a pitch for kind of the amazing sort of cultural touchstones that are throughout the entire play?
Yeah. So we've got some incredible pop culture references, right? There's a very sort of creative and poetic disassembly of Toto by Africa. We've got these really beautiful references to some great 80s songs like Quiet Riot's Come On, Feel the Noise. There's a beautiful and kind of disturbing scene that happens over a Tony Bennett song. We're referencing Carrie throughout. And yeah, I think culturally too, it is just such a beautiful dip back into the late 80s for anyone who has the memory of cassette tapes and VCRs and big blocky televisions and no cell phones, you know. It really does kind of like scratch all of those itches if you've got a little nostalgic sort of hankering for the 80s, even if you weren't in Northern Ireland in the 80s.
Yeah, it's all there. I also want to say this is my last sort of question before we get going, but I want to say congratulations kind of on the new season. I hope we get to talk about it next year. But
yes, for those
who maybe have already seen Crocodile Fever and are listening to this and are saying, I want more ICTC, can you just sort of give us a real quick rundown of the shows you have planned for Buffalo next year?
Absolutely. So our 25-26 season subscriptions are on sale now. Single tickets won't go on sale until the beginning of August. But we've got another docket of 5 shows, all of them Western New York premieres, I believe. We are starting with Or by Liz Duffy Adams, which is a sort of semi-historic romp through the 1660s, looking at the first Western England-based female playwright, Aphra Behn, and her relationship with King Charles II. And Nell Gwynn, who was very famously one of the first female actors of the time. It's beautiful because these people are contemporaries and alive during a lot of history that we would be aware of. And I think Aphra Behn is a tremendously important figure in Western drama that often doesn't get her due and doesn't get the same look as some of her contemporaries, like William Shakespeare, Christopher Marlowe. This playwright, Liz Duffy Adams, has a play called Born with Teeth on at the West End now that I believe is going to Broadway as well. And so it's really exciting to kind of be producing one of her works when her career is really experiencing such great success. So that's our Curtain Up show. And I'll be directing that with Jorge Luna. We're co-directing it. It'll be fun. It's kind of in some ways it feels like a Bridgerton treatment of the 1660s in England. Our second title is Thirst by Ronan Noon. It's a gorgeous companion piece to Long Day's Journey Into Night. And so Long Day's Journey Into Night follows the Tyrone family. And this piece looks at the two Irish servants and one American chauffeur who serve the family and are referenced throughout the text. It's a beautiful piece about immigration and longing and travel. And I think maybe one of the most beautiful plays I've read in a couple of years, and a gorgeous look at sort of the Irish American experience, especially for immigrants at the turn of the 20th century. That's running in November, and that'll be directed by Kate LaConte Alcocer, who is our advisory director. Then in February, we do Martin McDonagh's A Skull in Connemara, which is the only piece of his Linnane trilogy that we haven't produced at Irish Classical. We're really excited to do that. It is it's a Martin McDonagh play. It is dark and funny and sort of set in that kind of Irish Gothic noir world that a lot of his other pieces are. That'll be directed by Mason Beggs, who just directed Dorian for us this past year. And then after that, we move on to a new musical called Islander, conceived by Amy Draper, book by Stuart Melton, and music and lyrics by Finn Anderson. It is a new folk musical about community and connection, and it uses the voices of two actors who are singing a cappella and accompanied only by a live looping system of their own voices. So they create the whole soundscape of this world. The music is gorgeous. And that's a piece that is suitable for audiences of most ages, I would say, a kind of family-friendly piece. And then we finish the season with the North American premiere of Marina Carr's Girl on an Altar, which we're very excited to have. We've done a couple of Marina's plays previously, most recently the May. And it is a loose retelling of the Clytemnestra and Agamemnon relationship and stories surrounding the Trojan War. That'll be directed by Anderson Carr, who was a colleague of mine when I was in school in Ireland. And I'm excited to have him back. And, or not back, in Buffalo for the first time, but I'm excited to be working with him again. And I will be acting in that one as well.
Fantastic.
So it's a pretty, thank you. Yeah, it's a rich season. There's a little bit of something for everyone. A lot of revisitations of classic texts or time periods with a little bit of comedy and tragedy mixed in.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, those are my questions for today, but I just want to sort of always, I always like to end by saying, is there anything you feel was left unsaid or anything you want to share with our listeners before we say goodbye?
Gosh, no, you're so thorough. I guess, no, just, well, I have a moment of gratitude for everybody who collaborated with us on the 24-25 season, which was the first one that I programmed here. I have been so impressed by the caliber of talent in Buffalo and also the sense of community. And so I'm just really, really excited to continue sharing with our audiences and new audiences the incredible work and talent that exists here in town. So I hope that you join us next season.
Fantastic. Keely Sheridan, thank you so much for chatting today. It was great chatting with you.
Thank you, Dan.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Keely. Crocodile Fever is running through June 15th at the Andrews Theater in Buffalo, New York. Tickets are available in the show notes and at irishclassical.com. This episode was produced by Jessica Marinelli. Sarah Potter engineered this episode. In addition to this podcast, you can check out our local event guides posted bi-monthly on buffalorising.com. Make sure you subscribe to the show. If you like this show, please recommend it to a friend. Thanks for listening to Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising, Local Matters Studios.